Coming. I know that there's a lot of other, a couple other places you could be right now, so I do appreciate it. I'm actually super excited for this topic. It's something I've been thinking about. In fact, I started writing a book about this very topic, but for kids. Not with this exact title of How to End a Civilization, but with the idea that there are certain things happening in society that are leading us towards problems. And so the way I want to play this out is kind of like as we evaluate what's out there, if I was purposely trying to destroy civilization, right? So if I was trying to end the American experiment, what are some things I think I would do as the, you know, the manipulator and as the person trying to destroy? So that's kind of how this is going to play out. And then hopefully also offer a couple suggestions of, okay, if I was trying to stop that, what would I do? So that's kind of how this will go. But it just so happened, it's we hadn't planned it this way, but just last 2 weeks ago, Elizabeth and I had a chance to go to Rome. And so we were standing in front of the Colosseum, and I was thinking about this just a little bit, and we had this incredible adventure. But I started thinking about, you know, the Roman Empire and the Roman civilization. And one of the cool things about the Colosseum, it's been largely reconstructed as it was before, but one of the cool things is you go inside, and some of you guys have probably seen this, but as you go in, there would have been a floor here. This is the Colosseum is all around, and this is the floor, and then underneath the floor, you can see this labyrinth of different maze areas and all of these things. So that was the area where they would literally bring the gladiators from a ways away under the ground into this area, and they would stage things in this area. And the reason it had to be a labyrinth is because they would have human gladiators. They would have tigers and lions and all kinds of other things, and they had to try to keep them separated. And then the really intriguing, interesting part was that you can kind of see it right here in the corner, but all around this floor, there were trap doors with an elevator system. And so you can imagine in the Colosseum, as they would start these battles, they would literally bring people up from underneath the ground onto the Colosseum floor for everybody to watch the experience. And so as I was thinking about this, it came to me that, you know, the Roman Empire, there were a lot of reasons that it eventually collapsed. You know, there a lot of things that could happen. And I think you could look at our civilization now, and it's kind of like this labyrinth. It's very interwoven, and so the things that I say today and talk about today are not, you know, this is not an authoritative talk about how a civilization ends. And it's not even going to be pointed directly to Rome, but again, it's going to be some of the things that I see as we move along. But it really is like this labyrinth. And so, so let's do talk about Rome for just a second, though. Again, many reasons why Rome fell, including the vastness of it, the inability to monitor and control all of this enormous Roman Empire. Of course, the moral decay that happened over the years. But one of the things that we point to most often about why Rome collapsed was around 400 AD, Diocletian, who was the emperor at that time, decided that Rome had gotten too big to manage by himself. And so he split Rome into West and Eastern Roman Empire. Now, it was still all the Roman Empire, but it was managed and directed and led by two different groups. So some of them were in Constantinople and the other one set up in Milan. Not Rome, as we oftentimes think. And from those two locations, they led these two distinct groups. Over time, it became a problem because there was a lot of back and forth and kind of a juggling for resources for where the army should go to protect people. And so relatively quickly after this happened, the western part of Rome was the first part to fall. It was because they were being attacked so voraciously from up here, the tribes of Germania and other places. And so Western Rome fell pretty quickly. Eastern Rome kind of stayed together for another, you know, several hundred, almost 1,000 years. But this idea stuck with me, which is if I was going to try to destroy a civilization, I would first try to divide a civilization. And if you think about tribalism and how it's always played out, tribalism has been something that's been very beneficial to us as humans since the very beginning. You know, as an individual, I love the movie The Croods. Do you guys remember the movie The Croods? So, at the beginning of The Croods, he's like, yeah, we had these friends and they died, right? And then we had these other friends and they died, right? Everybody by themselves were being killed. And I think that's closer to reality, right, than what we probably think. That as individual families or individuals by themselves, life was very, very difficult. So tribalism, this idea that let's get together, let's share some resources, let's do independent jobs, became a powerful way for people to survive. And so as societies developed, this tribalism strengthened them. And even today, I think it could be a positive thing. So for example, we were sitting in Prague, at the Prague airport, and we were listening and talking to each other, and then we heard somebody from behind us speaking in English and with an American accent. And so they heard us speaking, we heard them speaking. They turned to us and they said, hey, where are you guys from? We're like, oh, we're from Idaho. And then we're like, they're like, oh, we've been to Idaho before. And all of a sudden we had this connection, right? It's like, oh, awesome. Like, you're from other, we're both Americans. Now we're over in Prague. We didn't know anything about each other. We had no connection whatsoever. But, oh, you're from the United States. I've been to Idaho. And suddenly we had something that was like this connection. Well, that's tribalism, right? It's this commonality that brings us together in a very positive and beneficial way. However, that being said, so remember, if I was trying to destroy civilization, I would try to divide. And in our modern society, we have taken this tribalism and we've taken it from a cultural, a way to coexist and survive, and we've turned it into something else. And so if you think about modern day tribalism, this is way smaller than I thought it would be. I'm sorry, guys. I would have made these much bigger. But we've now started to divide ourselves in so many different ways, right? There's almost no end to the list of the ways that we try to divide ourselves. You know, we do it by race. We do it by socioeconomic status. We do it by political affiliation. Young, old men, women, you know, around here, member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, not a member. And we start to divide ourselves, not in an effort to increase cultural impact or to survive or to be beneficial, but we do it because it helps us to feel a little more comfortable. We do it because we get into this place where we can start hearing ideas that echo our own, and we like that, right? And so in this modern tribalism, we've gone from a beneficial thing to now it becomes, well, we're good and they're bad. We're right and they're wrong. We're worthy, unworthy, rational, irrational, true, and false. And this has become, in my opinion, one of the bigger problems that we have as a society is we are so good at separating that it's very difficult to see how we'll ever pull us back together. And then you add to that this.
Did you draw that? Nephi, could you go back to that previous one?
Sure.
Just really quick.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
You know, there's a lot of ills of social media. I just spend a lot of time with your kids talking about dopamine addiction and that kind of stuff, and that's a huge problem. I actually think this might be a bigger struggle and a bigger concern for me as a society than even the dopamine. Because now we can, regardless of how crazy or bad your ideas or thoughts are and the way you want to divide yourself from everyone else, you can find someone else with that perspective or with that. And so we can create these miniature tribes with people from all over the world. And what happens with bad ideas is the more we hear it from someone else, it's almost like this confirmation bias, and we start to believe it even stronger, and it creates a really caustic way of having these tribes. And so social media and online groups and things have exacerbated and amplified and caused this division to be even stronger. And so that's hugely problematic for us as a society. Then let's take another layer of this, and let me just, a little caveat to this. I'm going to talk about victim mentality and victimhood, and I'm not talking about people have been truly victims of crimes or some terrible thing, right? What I'm referring to is we have started to divide ourselves as by levels of victimhood of ourselves or our race or our culture, right? And so if you had to line it up, So a black person is, we can start saying, well, you were victimized and you were victimized, and it's almost like this competition to see who's victimized more. And I see this, it's often, you guys are going to laugh at this. So sometimes when we're camping, I've been on a lot of girls' camps, right? And so the girls will go in their tent, and I've talked to my daughters about this. I'm like, you guys get into a victim Olympics. And she's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, well, one kid will be like, well, my parents, man, they wouldn't let me go to this thing. They're so bad. And then the next girl's like, well, that's not bad at all. My parents, like, they won't do this and that. And then the next girl's like, and by the end, it's like they're talking about if, like, somebody has truly victimized them and it's awful. They compete to see who is the bigger victim. Now, obviously, we have to talk about true victimhood, and we have to be concerned with that. However, it doesn't do anybody any good to start layering out these victim categories, right? It's just division at the end of the day. It's another way to divide a society. So we have tribalism and we have victimhood. And then finally, I think if I was really trying to divide a civilization, I would make it impossible for people to communicate with each other. Because once I've divided them into tribes and I've created a victim society, then I'm not going to let them talk to each other, right? I'm going to have some people decide that, well, we're going to ban everything, right? Like, we're not going to let anybody talk to anything that doesn't agree with the type of ideas that I have. And it's interesting because at both ends of the spectrum, we have this struggle politically, right? On one end, we say, well, hate, speech is hate. It doesn't work on the screen. If you guys want to read a really great book, I can't remember the name, but I have it on my notes here. One second. Let me see if I can see it. The Coddling of the American Mind. Have you guys read this? The Coddling of the American Mind speaks extensively about this idea that, no, speech is not violence. Speech is not hate. And when we start to describe speech as hate and violence, then we lose the ability to communicate one with another. And so, again, if I wanted to divide, I would create tribes, I would create a victim society, and I would start to create a system where you cannot speak to each other because the other side is just too wrong and too bullheaded, and it's not worth doing it anyway. Now, we don't see that anywhere in a modern society, luckily. So, we're okay. Now, so how do we break out of this? So let's talk about, first of all, we've got to get out of this social media tribalism. And so something I read or saw recently, some of you guys might know who Gary Vaynerchuk is. And he swears a ton, but he talks about business, and I watch some of his stuff. And Gary V once recently said, don't tell me that your algorithm is broken. He said, do this. If you want to do something good with your algorithm, go in today and do this 3 times today. Just go to your search bar and search kindness, and search greatness, and search heroic actions, and then see what content comes up. And do that for 3 days in a row, and the crap that you're getting in your feed will completely change, because you've taken action to actually move out of that tribalism that you're in and move into something that could be positive or uplifting. And if you really want to be crazy, go in there and type in a search for maybe an idea that you disagree with and start to interact with people who don't have the same viewpoint as you do.
Is it kindness, greatness, and hero?
Yeah, those are the ones he talked about. But you could put anything in there, right? Like, you could
anything
positive action. Yeah, you could really, and you really can. I tried this. You can completely change your feed. Now, I didn't see my motorcycles anymore, so I went back and I searched motorcycles because I still wanted to see that. But a lot of the other stuff that I didn't want to see was gone, which was really awesome. So we've got to break out of this social media tribalism and do better at trying to interact and engage with people from all walks of life. The second one comes from this story of Gary Davis. Has anybody heard Gary's story before? Gary Davis, back in the early 2000s, he was a musician. He was in a bar playing in North Carolina, and he was playing some music, and he finished and he went up and sat at the bar, and there was a man sitting next to him, and the guy turned to him and said, man, you're really good. You play like Jerry Lee Lewis. And so Gary responded, yeah, he was one of my inspirations. And the guy said, well, I've never heard a black man play music that's that close to stuff that I love. And so Gary started talking to him and said, well, he was one of my influences and inspirations, and he actually took a lot of his inspiration from, some of the black jazz musicians of the past, and they started to have this conversation. Well, come to find out, the man sitting next to him was a member of the KKK. And they started a friendship. And so over the next months and year, they started to do things together, they started to interact together, and this man eventually left the KKK, and Gary eventually became, he was the godfather of this man's daughter. Well, Gary had a crazy idea. His idea was, well, I bet a lot of these individuals who are stuck in this tribalism of the KKK, I bet they've never even talked to a black man. And so he said, I want to change that. And so he started going out, and he got this friend of his who had left the KKK. He said, could you give me a list of names of members of the KKK? And he said, sure. He said, I don't know what you want it for, but sure. And so he got this list, and he started reaching out to these individuals one at a time. He went and he met with the Grand Emperor over all of North Carolina, which is one of the highest levels of the KKK at that time, and met with him. And they struck up a conversation. They struck up a friendship. And a couple years later, he walked that man's daughter down the aisle. They became such good friends. And he left the KKK. And so he started, at this point, as I was reading this recently, he feels like there's been about at least 200 people that have left the Klan as a result of the actions that he has been taking.
200.
Now, that to me is incredibly inspiring, right? This idea that we have to be divided because of some tribalism that we've established is so wrong. And it doesn't have to be that way. But what it takes is someone that's willing to go and talk and listen and interact and have those conversations and truly listen from a perspective of, you know, Gary wasn't sitting there trying to say, well, you're an awful person. I think you're terrible. You know, I don't want to talk to you at all. He just wanted to understand. And so he just asked questions and they had this amazing conversation. Secondly, we've got to help our kids get out of this victim mentality. The world wants them to be victims. And I say that, I don't want to say that too strongly because I don't think everyone in the world wants them to be victims. But we have systems in place and processes in place that absolutely create this victim state, and they want them to stay in that victim state. And so I love Carl Jung, who said, I am not what happened to me, I am what I choose to become. And we can choose the outcomes that we're going to have. We can choose how we want to approach the world, independent of how our lives have played out and the types of things that have happened in the past. Now, there's obviously traumas that have to be dealt with, but that doesn't define us. It doesn't mean that you have to be a certain way forever. And so we need to help our kids. And please, talk to your kids. And honestly, you use Victim Olympics. You can tell that story that I told. Like, we don't need, especially amongst our children, a lot of our children who are definitely not victims, they don't need to pick up this victim mentality for no reason, right? Like, we need to help them break out of that. And the third idea, and you guys all know this story. So 1936, leading up to World War II, Hitler had, you know, absolutely crazy ideas about many, many populations. But one of them was the idea, which was widely held at that time, that African Americans were just not human, that they were some subspecies and subhuman race. And he preached that very openly. So the 1936 Olympics come along, and of course Germany is hosting, and along comes Jesse Owens. So the guy on the far left here, and we've all heard the name of Jesse Owens, right? So Jesse Owens shows up, and he wins the 100-meter sprint, the 200-meter sprint, the long jump, and the 4x1 relay. That's the 4x1 relay team that they ran on. And we often hear about Jesse Owens, but we don't also hear about is on that same exact USA team, there were actually 18 other African Americans that competed. And many of them took home gold, silver, and bronze medals. And the US really dominated in that Olympic Games. And it's an amazing story of how they really stuck it to Hitler, right? Like that, and I think that's what we always talk about. But here's the concept that I want you to take away from this story, which is this. One of the worst things we do is when we hear bad ideas, we try to cover them up, or we try to censor them, or we try to push them aside so no one can hear those bad ideas. But that's not what Jesse Owens did. Hitler had a terrible idea. It was a ridiculous idea in retrospect. But instead of just pushing it aside, they combated that with a good idea. Instead of pushing bad ideas aside and just ignoring them, we need to highlight the difference. We need to interact with those ideas, and we need to let good ideas overcome the bad ideas. Because if you don't, in our modern society, in the tribalism that we have, they're going to take that bad idea, and even if you ignore it, they're going to go into their tribe and they're going to continue to think it's a good idea. We have to be better at interacting with these bad ideas and showing the proof of why it's a bad idea. And standing up and having those conversations and going through and figuring out why it's a bad idea and help them understand that. If we just push the bad idea to the side, which is, you know, prior to what we did with Hitler for way too long prior to the U.S. actually entering the war and prior to England getting involved, was we just ignored him. He had terrible ideas and he was very open about those terrible ideas. And we just chose to act like they weren't bad ideas or like that will eventually go away. Well, they didn't go away. We had to stand up to those bad ideas. And yet in our modern society, we tend to want to just ignore or censor or block or whatever. But that doesn't help us unite. That just allows us to remain divided in our little tribes. And so I challenge you to more often engage with bad ideas. Not in a conflict way. You don't have to fight anybody, but we can compare and contrast and have those conversations. We're losing that ability as a society. And I guess the extension of that, of course, is our kids, right? How often do you ask your kids, let's take a terrible idea, right? Some terrible idea that's out there. How often do you ask your kids, or tell them the idea, let them know that it's out there, and then say, what's good about that idea? Why do you think those people believe that? And help them understand that on the other side of that bad idea are just people who have a belief system that's a little bit different than ours. And help them understand why they have that belief system. And help them understand that they can still communicate with those people. Like, we need to engage our kids with some of these ideas, but we can do it in a very kind and open way. And then once you've helped them understand the good behind it, because there is good behind most of those ideas. I mean, the education system is a great example, right? The education system that it is right now is a bad idea. It's not working, and we continue to hammer it, doing it the exact same way. Now, we're homeschoolers, so we're kind of ignoring that, right? But the fact is, there's a lot of good intention and a lot of good people behind those systems. And not often enough do we recognize that and talk about the good and the intention and what they're trying to accomplish. So it gives us a foundation to then come back and talk about why it's a bad idea. And so we have to engage more often in bad ideas. We have to take disunion and turn it into union if we truly want to save this thing that we call the American experiment. Because honestly, this division that we are driving into will eventually destroy us if it doesn't stop. Like, we cannot continue as a society being more and more and more divided on these things. We have to start finding the common ground and the places where we can converse and at least talk about these things. All right, let's switch topics. So if I was trying to destroy civilization, I would convince everyone that it's easy to make money and that passive income is the goal and that we all want to work towards just having this relaxed, easy way of life that doesn't require any sacrifice or any work. That sounds pretty good to most of us. Now, I was with a group of kids, like 20 to 32, they're kids to me, but I guess they're adults, young adults, and about 2 weeks ago in Prague, and had these great conversations, and I asked them, well, what do you guys think of like passive income? What is your idea? And they're like, oh, it sounds great. Like, they were so excited about this idea of like, eventually want to get to a point where they don't have to work anymore. But the point of that was, I flipped it on them like I'm going to do right now with you guys as well, is the point of our lives is not to get to a point where we don't have to work anymore. That's hugely problematic as a society. In fact, they did a research study where they were looking at retirees and people retired from their work, they were looking at like, what's the, after retirement, what does mortality look like? What's the length of their lives? And they found something really interesting. For every year that someone stopped working early, and then stopped working, right? Like, it's not just like they retired and went and did something else, but they just stopped working. For every year that they retired early, they lost 3 years of their life. Their mortality went down 3 years. And so they discovered that, you know, people who just retire and stop working completely, they die relatively quickly afterwards because they lose a really critical and important part of what makes us human, which is work. My grandfather He was a minor. So he was born in the 30s, didn't have a father, so at a very young age had to start helping provide for his family. And so he started mining when he was quite young. He got to, in fact, when I was first born, he was still mining. But when he was about my age, I think he was 47, he was starting to have a hard time breathing. And his lungs were just, I mean, he'd been mining in all kinds of mines, gold and coal and everything you could imagine. And so he went to the doctor, and the doctor said, you know, I have some bad news. Like, your lungs are shot. Like, you're not going to survive very long. He said, well, my grandson says, so what does that mean? And the guy said, you will be lucky to live 6 more years when he was 47 because your lungs have just been absolutely destroyed. Well, my grandfather didn't like that, so he said, well, what do I do? And the doctor said, there's nothing to do. You've destroyed your lungs. However, if you want to live a little longer, there's one thing you could do to try to do that. He said, you need to, like, work your lungs like you have never done in your entire life. Like, you need to expand and contract your lungs every day, more than a marathon running. You have to get out and just work till you can't breathe anymore, catch your breath, and then work some more. Well, my grandfather was like, okay, if that's what it takes. And so he, every day, just became the most insane worker you would ever, like, I remember he was in his, like, late 60s, early 70s when I was young, and we would go out, and he would work me into the ground all day long. Like, I just could not keep up with this 70-year-old man. He could work. But he would go out, he would dig a hole, and then he'd fill it back in, and he'd dig another hole and fill it back in. Like, he just, every day, he woke up with, like, what can I do to get my lungs to expand and contract, expand and contract? And, like I said, he went on to live not 6 months, but 30 additional years because he just worked like crazy. You guys, we have to re-enshrine this idea. And I know I'm preaching to the choir with you guys. You're doing this. But our kids have to understand that work is the goal. The goal is not to get to a point where we make enough money or we have enough that we don't have to work anymore. The goal of having a lot of money is we get to choose how we work. But we still work. Work is the goal. Work is something that will continue. And we want it to continue because it gives us a lot in our lives. Obviously, physical strength, but mentally it keeps us aware. It gives us purpose. It gives us hope. There's so many things that come along with that idea of work, and we are losing it as a society. If you talk to a group of teenagers, they think that they are going to go out and be a YouTube star and get some rental properties and have passive income for the rest of their life, and they're going to have to work again in the rest of their life. That is the dream. But that can't be the dream. We just can't let them have that dream. It's not the dream. We have to help them understand what actually is the dream, which is do great work in the things that you want to do. All right. If I was trying to destroy society, I would try to create a group of individuals that were depressed, anxious, and overwhelmed. And of course, we don't have this in our society at all, right? But we live in a time, it's really interesting to me, because we live in the most abundant time in the entire history of the world. We have more advantages and more things at our fingertips than has ever been. And yet we live in also the time where more people are depressed, anxious, and even suicidal than at any other time in the history of the world. It doesn't seem to match up, right? You would think that this abundance would cause opportunities that would give us the happiness that we're seeking, that we should be less depressed, but that's just not the case. One idea that I think is powerful in this, and some of you may have seen this before, it's relatively well known in the counseling circles, but there's this idea that on a time scale and accomplishment scale, all of us have some expectation, right? We establish this expectation of what we think we should be doing, and we all do it, right? At this age, I should be like this, or these people are that way, and I should be that way too at a certain point. And so we think we should be accomplishing something and at some particular time in our lives. But then there's reality, which is kind of where we really are. And that reality and expectation, there becomes, at every time scale, there's a gap between the expectation and the reality of our lives. And we call this the anxiety gap. And that anxiety gap is where a lot of our anxiety and depression originate, because we look up, here we are in our real life, you know, our kids are our kids, and they act the way that they act, and it's not always what we want it to be, right? And our careers are what they are, and our businesses are doing what they do, even though we had visions of them, you know, churning over tens of millions of dollars a year, they're not, and they're harder than we thought they would be. And so there becomes this anxiety gap. And you guys, this is what drives so much of that anxiety and depression. Now, again, another caveat, this is not referring to clinical, you know, depression and clinical anxiety. We have those things as well. But there's also a very large group amongst those who are anxious and depressed who are just struggling with the fact that there's this anxiety gap. Well, you take that and you add to it this social media crap. And you guys, I cannot harp on this enough. One of the greatest ills of social media is that it causes us to see some unrealistic expectation that's not possible to ever achieve, and it gives us even a larger anxiety gap, right? Our worst days, or our normal days are never going to compete with the Instagram model's best days and their best minutes and their best hours. They just can't compete, and yet we act like they will, right? It looks like such a great idea. I like to work out, I like to lift weights, and so I get all the time the reels that come in about eat this way, like if you'll just eat these high protein meals and then, you know, you'll turn into this ripped dude and everything will be fine. I'm like, that's awesome. I just need that cookbook and I just need to make those meals, the protein meals, and I'll be, no, of course not. But I get this expectation anxiety gap because I feel like, man, I try to eat healthy. I try to work out, but I'm still not there. And so it just drives it over and over and over. And so you guys, we have to for ourselves, please be kind enough to yourself to at least modify that expectation, okay? And help your kids to realign. Now, I'm not asking you to give up on dreams and give up on expectations. I'm not saying that your expectations have to match reality. We should have some expectations. And some anxiety is a good thing. It drives us to do great things. But when it becomes so overwhelmingly large, we lose the ability to keep perspective. And so for our kids, how do we do that? We have to get them out of that social media world. We just cannot allow it to happen in their lives. I talked to your kids a lot this morning about this idea of generation dopamine. They are living at a time where every second of their lives, there is a dopamine hit that they can have. They can have it instantaneously in every aspect of their lives. That's hugely problematic. But then at the same time, they're getting slammed with this dopamine, but they're also getting hit with this expectation and anxiety gap, and it's just destroying them. And, you know, I am an advocate for just eliminating it out of their lives completely if possible, but sometimes that's not reality and it's not possible, and eventually they're going to have it on their own. And so at the very least, we have to help them set appropriate limits on these things. We have to help them pull out of that stuff more often. We have to try to close this anxiety gap. And if they're looking at all of these peers on there all the time, it's not going to happen because their expectations are going to be crazy and unrealistic. Any questions or thoughts at this point? Yeah.
My homeschooling, how it's just occurred, is very different from public school and even other homeschool moms. And I think I'm very proud of what I've accomplished and protected my kids from. But I also, and I'm sure all of you moms have had to battle this, have had the pressure of this and the pressure of that, saying, well, you're not doing this and this and this and this and this, and your kids aren't academic and your kids aren't this, and they don't have sports and they're not good at this. So it's kind of, I've been able to train myself to push all of that away, except laundry as a good thing, a successful thing that day, dishes, and loving all of it, and pouring confidence in my children so that they don't have all of the junk. And it's still obviously every day working on it, but I think if we push away all of that other stuff and say others' opinions and thoughts are not my reality and don't matter. I release them with love, and I get to do what I get to do with confidence. So that was a big journey for me, and I think all of us need to accept what we're doing, and yeah. then embrace that and be confident in what we're doing for our kids. Because these are our kids, not the world, not this and that person.
Yeah.
It's our kids. And that's
great.
Where I come
no, it's so awesome, and it's a daily battle, right? Like it's constantly.
Daily, yeah.
So do you have a question back here or a comment?
So I've had the privilege of living throughout the United States. Away from here is exactly, but the whole keeping up with the Joneses thing is really big in this area, I feel like, but you go elsewhere in the United States and it doesn't matter. But like when we lived elsewhere, our kids weren't old enough to realize it. Not everybody has to have a new car and everything, but here it's like our kids are so, they just want everything that everybody else has. Like, what's your opinion on how do you teach them? They don't have to have everything. Like, it's okay to go ahead.
Yeah. So I talked today with kids. One of them was this idea of delayed gratification. Do you guys remember the marshmallow example? So the marshmallow experiment? I love the marshmallow experiment because they followed those kids after the marshmallow experiment. Basically, they put them in and said, if you wait, you know, a certain amount of time, we'll give you more marshmallows. And these are like little kids. And so then they watched them, and they watched how if they would eat the marshmallow or if they'd actually wait to get more. And they tracked those kids for a long time, and they found that the kids that could wait were significantly more successful and happier throughout the rest of their lives. This idea that building up the ability to delay gratification, it's not even about we don't have the money to do it, we don't have the ability, opportunity, it's that it's a good thing in your life to be able to delay that gratification. And so we have to teach that pretty clearly, I think. And then just recognize that I also like to help the kids understand, okay, let's play this out, right? Like, let's imagine we get everything. Like, what's the outcome of that? What's the benefit? What's the positive? Like, and go back to, if we want to introduce them to these other ideas, but we also want to point out, like, hey, that's good people, but what's the end game? And point to examples where that is not beneficial. Like, it doesn't end up the way you want. And there's a lot of examples of people who have nothing, who build great, amazing lives that we can point to as the good ideas to compare and contrast those things to. That's a really good question. All right, yes.
So I have this little bit of a conflict kind of in my mind because I used to do posts on Instagram because I wanted to be able to inspire homeschool moms, large family moms in particular. And I got a pretty big following. And then I started getting really worried that I was setting an expectation and maybe hurting people more than helping because of that expectation, you know? But it's like, this is true, and this is reality, and this is how your home can be, and this is how great homeschool can be. But then I think we all tend to, like, compare ourselves on the bad day and kind of say, so how do you lead and inspire and lend a positive voice to the mingling that is out there, but not be a part of this anxiety and the destruction that's happening to so many moms and families?
Yeah, it's such a great question, and it's such a hard balance, right? Because we do want to inspire. In fact, we'll talk about that in just a second. We need to, our kids need hope, right, at the end of the day, right? And we need hope. It can't all just be like it's awful and terrible. But I find that we have to inject reality into all of those things. And I don't like to follow accounts of people who are just, like there's these travel accounts. We love to travel. And there's the travel accounts with the beautiful music and these amazing places, right? Those are interesting to see. But I actually like the stuff that comes up and says, we went to this beautiful place and then it wasn't actually what we thought it was going to be. Have you seen those ones where it's like, here's what it really looked like, and here was the experience, and here's like the car that broke down, and like, and I think, because to me it's inspiring. They went out and did something, this amazing trip that was unbelievable, and it wasn't exactly perfect, but it was still unbelievable and inspiring. And so I think as we inject, we make it aspirational, but we inject some of the reality. I was talking to the kids today about my experience on Kilimanjaro and climbing Kilimanjaro, and it was unbelievable. but it was not easy, and it was not glamorous or beautiful. Like, it was really, really difficult. And so I injected a lot of that reality into that story to also highlight that. So I don't know if that helps, but that's something that always helped me. So,
You were saying how you tried to limit or cut, like, their social media and things. What are some of your ideas or things you've done to help your kids not be into the social media as much?
Yeah, so one thing is, you know, social media, my strong belief is no social media at all till they're 16. Like, they just can't, their brains are not developed enough to handle social media at all until they're 16. We kind of messed this up with our older daughter. We probably gave her a phone a little bit earlier than I would have liked, now that I look in retrospect. So nothing until they're 16. And then we like to see the kids engaging, right? There's a difference between scrolling and consuming social media and engaging with and contributing to social media. And I think if you turn them towards those positive portions of it, it can be beneficial in small doses. But we haven't done anything more to, like, limit the time, other than I use some of the controls that we have to limit the device, how much time an app will be available. And Ainsley and I, my second oldest daughter, we go back and forth all the time. She's like, I need 5 more minutes on that. And I'm like, no, you don't. And yes, I do. Tell me why. And we have this conversation. I'm like, okay, I'll give you 5 more minutes. So we have that back and forth, but I have the control over those things. Yeah.
How are you defining social media? Is it a two-way conversation? Is it just information gathering? What are you talking about?
So social media to me is anything where something can be posted and then interacted with by somebody else, and, you know, that can be liked or disliked, and then social media also has this aspect of continuity. So it's this continual run thing. So I don't consider, like, texting, that kind of stuff, that's not social media, but it's all of these other things that draw you in, and they have an algorithm that drives the content to you directly. 2 minutes, oh no, okay. And Rosie said you have to be done at around time, so let me just tell you about this really quickly. You guys, our kids need hope. So again, if I was trying to destroy a civilization, I would make it hopeless and depressing and anxious. They did a rat study, Carl Richter, back in 1957. Some of you guys might know this study. They took rats and they placed them into a tub of water. And they monitored them and they watched them how long they would churn water before they gave up and drowned. And so they timed them, and these rats would go for an average of about 6 to 7 minutes before they would give up. And so right at the moment that the rats gave up, they would reach in and they would save them. They would pull them out of the water. So 6 to 7 minutes, pull them out, they dried them off, and then they put them right back into the water to see how long they would go now that they're tired, right? And so you'd expect that these rats that are super tired would now just go another minute or two and probably drown, because they've already exerted themselves to the point of giving up and drowning. Well, what they found was they started the timer, and the rats swam, and they swam, and they swam, and they swam for an additional 60 hours. So they went from 6 to 7 minutes the first time before they died, and now they went, putting them back in, they went 60 hours before they drowned. And the recognition of what they found out was, these rats, the first time, didn't know anything about the environment they're in. They just, like, I can't, there's no way to get out, I might as well give up and die. But the second time, they're like, well, somebody saved me. And I'm just going to keep swimming, because someone's definitely going to save me. And they just kept going and going and going for 60 additional hours. You guys, we have to instill hope back into our kids. The world, it's trying so hard to tell us that it's hopeless. There's not enough. Robots can take over everything, all this crap, and we just have to prepare them for the fact that, look, this world is great. No matter what happens, if robots do take over jobs, there's still so much, like, there's so much hope and opportunity. Help your kids and help yourselves understand, we truly live in the most abundant, opportunity-filled time in the history of the world. There's never been a better time to be here. There's more comfort, there's more abundance, there's more opportunity. Like, it's just all there. And yet we so easily allow ourselves and our kids to start to think that it's the worst time. Because we talk about all this other stuff way too often, maybe. And we don't talk about the good that's happening often enough. You guys, thank you for your attention. I will talk more, but we got to stop. But thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.